being a slight mini.
Okay.
I'll turn it down, I'll turn it up when you start to talk.
Okay. So that you can see my eyes when you attack me, right? Yeah, right.
Up and coming meaning which particular molecule or
it will be a variety of singlet sigmas. So contrasting how they're the same, how they're different sort of things. So. But I'll also just briefly mention what the other sorts of molecules that might be up and coming as well. You know, one slide. So, but yeah, most of what I'll talk about singlet sigma.
So, okay, welcome back for the last session today. The first talk is going to be by Michael Wall from the Colorado School of Mines, and he's going to talk about many body physics with up-and-coming molecules in optical light.
All right, thank you. So, as always, I'd like to thank you all for being here. Thank the organizers for a great conference. I'd also like to thank the organizers for the entire program. I've been here since January, and it's been a lot of fun. So this is work we've done at the Colorado School of Mines together with my PhD advisor, Lincoln Carr, and also Arman Bekaroglu, who's here. So when I say up-and-coming molecules, what do I mean? So mostly what I will talk about today are singlet sigma molecules, which are what are naturally formed when you put two alkali metal atoms together. So we've heard about a couple different species of this week during the conference, for example, KRB at JILA and RBCS, which we just heard about earlier today. And we heard from Jeremy Hudson how to sort of assemble two atoms together to form molecules through, for example, magneto-association. And so singlet sigma really refers to the fact that there is no electronic spin left of any sort. So all the orbital angular momentum is tied up, and all the spin angular momentum is tied up. So the simplest extension beyond that would be to have a free electron spin left, and that would be a doublet sigma molecule. We've also heard about some of these throughout the conference, so this strontium monofluoride, and then yttrium monoxide is out there in the poster session. These may be able to be laser cooled, for example, or you can assemble them, as Jeremy also talked about this morning. We also have this doublet pi molecule, OH, which is being formed from evaporative cooling. And then sort of other molecules which might be on the near horizon, for example, symmetric tops, say methyl fluoride, because they have a linear Stark effect, they might be able to be very easily Stark decelerated. And I'd like to advertise the wiki for the program here, because we've had lots of discussions throughout the program on what sorts of molecules might be possible, different things we can do with them, et cetera, et cetera. So I encourage you to go there and poke around and see all the great things that have been going on here. Okay. So what's new in the many-body sense with molecules? So the first thing that comes to mind are these large electric dipole moments that we've heard a lot about. So in a simple model of polarized dipoles, you end up with interactions between two dipoles, which go like the dipole moment squared divided by their separation cubed, and have this sort of D wave dependence. So if two dipoles are aligned next to each other, they're repulsive, whereas if they're aligned head to tail, they're attractive. Okay, so a lot has been studied for this sort of structureless dipole problem for ultra-cold gases. So for Bose gases, there have been several interesting predictions, in particular in confined geometries. So if you confine a dipolar BC by squeezing on it in sort of a pancake type geometry, then for momenta, which are in some sense small to this compared to this interlayer spacing, you really only see the repulsive part of this potential. But then as the momentum becomes larger, you see the attractive part, and this leads to a minimum in the dispersion here, the so-called Roton minimum. In addition, you can have interesting shapes of the actual BEC cloud, like this red blood cell BEC that arises from the anisotropic nature of the interaction. In addition, Fermi gases are also modified. There's an anisotropic Fermi liquid picture. And you can also induce interesting sorts of pairing physics, BCS-type pairing physics. Okay, so what happens when you load dipoles into optical lattices? Well, I don't have anywhere near as extensive a list as Alexei did, but I'll just mention this one image which came up earlier in the week during Guido's talk as an example of some interesting physics of dipoles in optical lattices. So there's this devil's staircase of insulating phases, which means that there are crystalline phases of any rational density in the classical limit, so a very small tunneling or very large interactions. And Guido also talked about that as you move away from this half-filled crystalline phase, you can get interesting super solid phases on the square lattice in 2D. So now the question that I'll pose is, are strong dipoles really everything that molecules have to offer for many-body physics? And of course, the fact that I asked the question means you know the answer. It's no. So molecules are much more interesting because they're very complex objects. They're much more than just structureless dipoles. In addition to being complex, we can tune all of their degrees of freedom. And this provides us with very different opportunities than solid-state systems, which typically have a few degrees of freedom in their sort of microscopic constituents. Okay. So to give an idea of what I mean by complex objects, considering the simplest case of the singlet sigma molecules, this really is a multi-scale problem in a single molecule which spans very many orders of magnitude. So at the top of the energy hierarchy is the electronic structure, which is related by how the two atoms which form a diatomic molecule are separated. This is on the order of EV or so, but this is important because this is what provides coupling to an optical lattice. And the fact that there are nearby states which have different molecular symmetry means that the polarizability which provides the coupling to the optical lattice is anisotropic. And this will be important later. So if we look sort of at vibrations in this potential well, then those are a few orders of magnitude smaller in energy scales. We won't worry about those very much. If we go even further down to rotations of the molecule about its center of mass, those form roughly the gigahertz scale of energy. And then if we zoom in on one of these rotational levels, sort of at the bottom of the energy hierarchy is the hyperfine structure. So the rotations are important because they couple to DC electric fields. They allow us to tunably access the dipole moments of the molecules. In addition, they allow us to access all of this internal structure through dipole-allowed transitions with microwaves. So the hyperfine, the alkali dimers, tend to have very large nuclear spins, and so they have quadrupole moments. This quadrupole moment mixes together the hyperfine degrees of freedom and the rotational degrees of freedom. And so by coupling to an external magnetic field, we can sort of control this degree of correlation between rotation and hyperfine spins. And this gives us more degrees of freedom that we can controllably access and work with. Okay, so this is sort of the schematic experimental setup that we'll consider when we're talking about many-body physics. We have three pairs of counterpropagating laser beams forming a simple cubic optical lattice. For each one of these beams. We can independently control the intensity, which controls sort of the quasi-dimensionality of the system, and the rate of tunneling molecules throughout the lattice. In addition, because the polarizability tensor is anisotropic, it's also important to talk about the polarization of the laser light. We'll apply a DC field along the space-fixed z-axis, which orients the dipole moments and shifts around the internal levels. Then we also consider applying this DC magnetic field somewhere in the XZ plane, which orients the nuclear spins. And then finally, an AC microwave field to couple in internal states of the molecule. Okay, so let's return to this picture. Now I want to talk about the actual degrees of freedom, which will be relevant in our many-body models. So these are down here, sort of at the bottom of the energy hierarchy. Alexei went through this very nicely just before me. If you look at the bottom two rotational levels, they're split by something on the order of gigahertz. The level with zero quanta of rotation is non-degenerate. The level with one quantum of rotation is triply degenerate. When we apply the electric field, these things are split by something of order the rotational constant, which is much larger than the typical dipole-dipole interaction. And so we can consider these levels to be essentially uncoupled by dipole-dipole interaction. So then we apply an AC microwave field, which enables us to talk about other internal states being populated in the problem. And then finally, zooming in on this bottom level, we see that there is, in fact, quite a bit of hyperfine structure. So this is, for example, for rhodium-cesium. As a function of the electric field, so this n equals zero level with respect to the average energy, this is sort of the hyperfine structure is a function of electric field, and you see it covers a range of a couple hundred kilohertz. And then, in addition, during magneto-association, there are typically very large magnetic fields applied. So for rubidium-cesium, I think the one they use is around 180 gauss. And so this is the hyperfine structure of that same level in a field of about 5 kilovolts per centimeter and around the high magnetic fields that they use. So these levels are, in fact, all widely split on the scale of the dipole-dipole interaction energy, as Alexei had mentioned. Okay, so before we talk about models for molecules and optical lattices, let's briefly revisit models for atoms and optical lattices. So for bosonic atoms, we find the well-known Bose-Hubbard model, which consists of two pieces. First is that atoms can tunnel between neighboring sites with associated energy T. If two atoms occupy the same site, there's an energetic cost to do that from S-wave scattering, which is given by U. So the Bose-Hubbard model is interesting for two reasons. First of all, it has a fairly long history in condensed matter, and so it's interesting that bosonic atoms and optical lattices can quantum simulate this, so it provides a tunable realization of something which is of importance to condensed matter physics. But on the other hand, it's interesting to an atomic physicist because it is the natural model which describes what ultracold bosonic atoms do in optical lattices. So when we ask, what about molecules? The quantum simulator question and the natural Hamiltonian question, I believe, split sort of into two complementary questions. So Alexei touched quite a bit on the first one, which is, now that we have all this rich internal structure and electric dipoles, how can we use cleverness to quantum simulate things from many-body physics or condensed matter with ultracold molecules and optical lattices? And the answer is given nicely by Alexei. You can see quantum magnetism and of course, several other people. Topological phases, fractional churn insulators. Maybe I'll just poke a little bit of fun at Alexei. This is an example of the vast amount of cleverness that is coming from here. And then the complementary question, which we would like to address, is just from the perspective of someone in ultracold atoms and molecules, if we just put them in a lattice and we don't fine-tune, and we don't say, how can we make this look like something from condensed matter, then what is the many-body physics that arises naturally? Okay, and we would like to put forward this something that we call the molecular Hubbard-Hamiltonian. And the three things that I would like to really discuss about the molecular Hubbard-Hamiltonian and many-body physics are to discuss the experimental controls we have sort of in the simplest experimental setups, to give some case studies for different molecules and different field regimes of the molecular Hubbard Hamiltonian, and to stress that different molecules in general give different physics, so we can consider different species even with the same molecular symmetries, another sort of experimental handle or experimental control we can use. Okay. So this is the molecular Hubbard Hamiltonian as outlined in these papers. We'll go through each term one by one. This first one represents detunings. It's effectively the internal energies of the molecule. So if we have some reference ground state that the molecules are prepared in, we turn on an AC microwave field which is resonant with this state in the N equals 1 manifold, then both of those will have no effective detuning, but these other states will have non-zero detunings. The next term is tunneling of molecules throughout the lattice. So now I've sort of drawn this schematic. We're imagining sort of a one-dimensional system. So moving in this direction corresponds to hopping in real space. But now we want to talk about the internal states of the molecules. And we'll index those by this index sigma. And those correspond to these different replicas of that one-dimensional system. So tunneling involves two of these Greek indices and only one sigma. So tunneling does not change the internal state of the molecule. It just hops back and forth in space. However, molecules in different internal states also tunnel, and the tunneling depends on the internal state. So it's just an example. It depends on the internal state because the polarizabilities of the different internal states are different. Just as for ultracold atoms, you can control the overall rate of tunneling by increasing the intensity of the optical lattice. And of course, just as for atoms, different molecules will have different tunneling rates because they have different masses. But in addition, because the polarizability tensor is anisotropic, you can also get a handle on the tunneling through polarization of the optical lattice light. This was explored nicely by Kotojikova and DeMille a few years ago. And so what I'm showing here is the polarizabilities, which give rise to the tunneling rates for the N equals 0 and the N equals 1 manifold of KRB, for polarization, which is parallel to the DC electric field and perpendicular to it. And that's just to say that you can change the tunneling of a particular state and the tunneling disparity between internal states by using all of these different knobs. And also, different polarizations can couple together the internal states of the molecule, and so can also change the character of your basis. Okay, the next term we consider are transitions in an AC microwave field. So this is transitions between two different internal states, which happen at the same spatial position. So this looks like a tunneling in internal space. And these are the effective Rabi frequencies for those transitions. So I'll show that here for KRV. So these are the 144 hyperfine states, which are the lowest two rotational levels of KRV. And now we're looking at all of the different dipole moments. So along the diagonals are the resonant dipole moments, and then all of these are the transition dipole moments, which give rise to these sorts of transitions. And so what I want to point out is that we can change which levels are allowed to transition by changing this angle between the electric and magnetic fields, because there is this quadrupole coupling of rotation and hyperfine spin. So we can change which states are dynamically accessible, and also sort of the rates of their tunneling, disorder in tunneling, et cetera, by using this additional control, which is the angle between electric and magnetic fields. Okay. So now the interaction terms, there's a dipole-dipole interaction, which is a resonant dipole-dipole interaction. It gives rise to density-density type interactions. In general, between molecules in different internal states and at different positions. I'll talk about the spatial dependence of this in a moment. And so as a function of electric field in these scaled units, where d is the permanent dipole moment and b is the rotational constant, we can put sort of all singlet sigma molecules on the same graph. And these would be the dipole moments, which give rise to these direct interactions for the two internal states. And then I'd like to point out that whenever you have these long-range sort of interactions, you should be careful to put some sort of self-consistent truncation on all of the long-range interactions which could possibly appear in a many-body model in order to be self-consistent. And so that's everywhere I have these truncation parameters, so the range of tunneling, the range of interaction, etc. Okay, the final terms, which are driven by the dipole-dipole interactions, are these exchange interactions, which Alexei also talked about, the flip-flop terms, where two molecules exchange their internal state. And there are also more complex processes, which Alexei pointed out. And these are driven by the transition dipole moments, given here as a function of the field. And the difference between these two, I would like to point out, is that this is the transition dipole moment computed in free space, and this is the transition dipole moment computed for a strong quasi-one-dimensional optical lattice. So as I mentioned, the polarization can strongly affect the internal state character, and in particular, that can strongly affect transition dipole moments, while it has much less of an effect on the resonant dipole moments. Okay. So a final experimental handle that I would like to bring up is the lattice geometry, so how strong it is in various directions. So it's been known for quite a while in the dipolar BEC literature that when you load a dipolar BEC into an anisotropic harmonic trap, that the effective dipolar energy depends very strongly on the anisotropy of the trap, because you experience more of the positive or more of the negative part of the dipole-dipole potential. So it's maybe not so surprising that the same occurs in a lattice. This is looking at the effective on-site energy of two particles localized on a particular lattice site, which lies slightly below the harmonic oscillator result, assuming the same local curvature of a lattice site, but they have the same sort of overall schematic form. But what we'd also like to stress is that this effect extends beyond just the on-site physics and confinement in the lattice sense. So going to quasi-1D, quasi-2-dimensional situations also changes the functional form of the dipole-dipole interaction in the lattice. It's no longer just a power law, but there's, in general, a short-range or exponential-type piece. And this can give rise to corrections of order 30-50% of the nearest neighbor interaction in quasi-low-dimensional scenarios, which are common in ultracold gases. So why is this? It's due in a large part to the fact that the localized states in a lattice are Vanier states. They're Fourier transforms of Bloch functions. And it can be shown under quite general conditions that these feature an exponential decay away from their central point of localization. So these are very heavy-tailed probability distributions. They're not like Gaussians and harmonic oscillators. And it really is these heavy tails which are important to this effect, and not just the width of the function. Okay, so the next two slides are some tables of numbers, but I'll walk through them fairly slowly. The things I really want to point out are to compare several different up-and-coming singlet sigma alkali dimer type molecules, and show how they are different with respect to many-body physics. So the first thing is, if we look at the permanent dipole moments, this span nearly an order of magnitude. But it's not just the dipole moment that matters. Also, the rotational constant matters in how much of this dipole moment you can squeeze out when you apply an electric field. So if we take a rough upper bound of electric field of 5 kilovolts per centimeter, then these dashed lines represent sort of the maximum range of the dipole moments that you can get for these different molecules. And in particular, the ratio of the exchange terms, which are these transition dipole moments, to the direct terms, which are these resonant dipole moments, are restricted in very different ways for the different molecules. And then finally, the most important term in the hyperfine Hamiltonian is this electric quadrupole coupling, and those also can differ very widely between the different molecules. Okay, so how does that single particle physics, single molecule physics, translate into many-body physics? So now, to give an idea of how these parameters change in different scenarios, we'll consider a quasi-one-dimensional case. So we'll tightly confine the molecules along y and along z and look at what these different coefficients turn out to be. So again, what I'm showing here at the top is the dipole-dipole interaction. At the nearest neighbor distance, r is the distance, and in the lowest state, so the n equals zero state. And if we fix the field strength at 1 kilovolt per centimeter, then we have a range of sort of the time scale for this sort of interaction. If we increase this to 5 kilovolts per centimeter, then this range can change dramatically by an order of magnitude for some species. Okay, we can also look at what are the interactions in the excited state, and they can be quite different from the ground state between all these different molecules. The same when we turn up the electric field. And then finally, let's look at how the tunneling scales with respect to these dipole-dipole interactions. And this is where we really start to see a very large difference between the molecules. So how easy it is for them to tunnel versus how strongly they interact through the direct dipole-dipole interactions spans a very vast range here. And in general, it's different in the ground state and in the excited state, how easily they can tunnel versus how strongly they interact. And then finally, the ratio of the exchange terms to the direct terms. This is limited by the electric field, but it is in general different for the different molecules. Okay. So now I'd like to just show some phase diagrams for different molecules and give a brief word on the methods that we use. We use matrix product state methods, which work directly in the limit of an infinite lattice. And so when we do this, we assume that our many-body wave function has some translational symmetry under some number of sites. It can be whatever number you like. We write down a matrix product state ansatz for this so-called unit cell. So a matrix product state is just a state which has restricted entanglement in some sense. And then we use this entanglement cutoff as a convergence parameter. And so these are some results of phase diagrams obtained using those sorts of numerical methods. We'll focus at first on lithium-cesium for a transition driven by the electric field in a quasi-one-dimensional setup from a phase out here, which is a superfluid. So the way we characterize it, we have a single particle density matrix, which gives sort of phase coherence of the system, and density-density correlation function, which talks about diagonal order. So out here, this is fermionic lithium-cesium, but we also assume hard core, so it's not terribly essential in one dimension. Yes. Fermionic, yes. Yes, in this case. Okay. So the single particle density matrix out here in the superfluid has an algebraic decay. The density-density correlation function also features an algebraic decay. But then as we move into this region of fixed density at 1/2, this is a crystalline phase. It has a long range but alternating order in the density correlation function and exponential decay of the single particle density matrix. So we will see this sort of phase transition in other molecules, so in fermionic sodium-potassium and also in bosonic rubidium-cesium, which is assumed to be hard core from the confinement. And then I'd also like to investigate for lithium-cesium another phase transition between a superfluid, this time into a third-filled crystalline phase. And this is not as a function of the electric field. We hold electric field fixed. But this time we change the lattice step, so to reduce the tunneling with respect to the interactions. Right. So in summary, I presented the molecular Hubbard Hamiltonian, which is sort of the natural Hamiltonian for describing many-body physics of singlet sigma molecules. This is complementary to the work of what we can quantum simulate for condensed matter systems, which Alexei talked about in detail. I showed case studies of how different singlet sigma molecules access different regimes of this Hamiltonian. I talked about a wide array of experimental controls, optical lattice intensity, and also polarization, strength of DC electric field, microwave field, the tunable coupling between the nuclear hyperfine states and the rotation with a magnetic field. I talked about how anisotropy in lattice confinement gives rise to modified long-range dipole-dipole interactions in a lattice, and also how species should really be considered as another experimental knob for these systems, that different molecules access very different regimes of the natural many-body physics. I talked briefly about many-body techniques and presented some simulations of quantum phase transitions, which may be seen in the near term. And we plan to open source these codes, which are amenable to long-range interactions in 1D. So if you're interested, please contact us. And here's some references for the work. We also have 4 posters out here in the common room. So please stop by and talk to us if you're interested more. Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much. Any questions or comments? I think there's one at the back.
How important is the dipole-dipole interaction for your phase diagram? Because it is 1D.
Yes.
In 1D, the fact that the dipole-dipole interaction is unity divided by RQ. Well, you take into account several lattices or whatever, and this is it.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it add qualitatively something to the phase diagram or not?
Yes. So this third field phase is only stabilized in the presence of longer range interactions than nearest neighbor. Right. So for these could be described to some degree of approximation using just nearest neighbor interactions, which are strong. But this one really requires the longer range interaction. So this is really dipolar.
Yeah,
physics.
This I do not understand very well. But why I'm asking this question, because if you have fermionic molecules in an optical lattice, two component fermionic system in 1D lattice with only on-site interaction, it's an exactly solvable model from the times of Godin and so on, long time ago. And the phase diagram is known. It's a superfluid or superconductor, if you wish, Latinger liquid. There is also an insulator state. What kind of qualitatively new physics you get compared to what is known for, let's say, such a system in quasi-1D?
Compared to
compared to
fermions with
yes.
Just on-site interaction?
Yes. What well, kind of new phases or what? What is so new in this respect? Or this is just the phase boundary shifted or whatever, or there is something really new?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say that this is an example of a phase that is really new. I mean, the classical limit of this is particle empty site, particle empty site, empty site, right? So it's a it has periodicity 3, and you wouldn't see a phase like that just with on-site interactions. That requires longer range interactions. So.
But people have also considered in literature next to nearest neighbor interaction, next to nearest neighbor interaction, and 1D, and mm-hmm. so on, adding to the existing on-site interaction
mm-hmm.
model.
Mm-hmm.
Did they observe this type of phases or not?
They may have, you know, I mean, there's certainly charged density wave phases when they're okay. Next neighbor interactions, right?
Okay.
So in the case where you consider hopping of rotationally excited molecules, so I guess you need to assume hardcore because
yes.
Otherwise they can hop in sort of this rotational quenching.
Right.
So do you assume that this is stabilized by sort of large decay on a site? Because I don't think if you have, you know, many, if you have several rotational states involved, I don't think there is a way of easily, or there is a way, but it's not very easy to come up with the configurations where interaction will be purely repulsive in such a way that unitary interactions alone prevent you from hopping. So you're relying on the Zeno effect. Is that roughly?
Well, I mean, what I showed here for the confinement effects, right, is that, in fact, you know, this is in units of d squared over a cubed, essentially, right? So this is the on-site interaction due just to the dipole-dipole interaction.
But this is identical dipoles? I mean, identical states? Because you have several states, then you need to consider all possible combinations of internal states of the two molecules. You want them all to be repulsive from all directions. So I think that's hard to get. So
yeah, probably that would be hard to get, but you know, if you polarize perpendicular to the plane and then you squeeze them down very tightly, this squeezing down leads to a very large on-site.
But what I'm saying is that if you want to have hopping of several, you know, rotational states, then you probably quantum Zeno effect will be the only way to stabilize that. That's why I'm always wary of writing hops of.
Sure.
But I still do.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
I was wondering how stable your model with respect to these parameters, say dipole moments. I don't think they written in stone, right? So there are some controversy about certain values, right? So certainly for rubidium, cesium, for example. Mm-hmm. And you also have the transitional dipoles, right, in your model. So those are probably even harder to nail down accurate values. So have you checked if your phase diagram changes if you sort of change those parameters?
Yeah, certainly they'll shift, but I think they shift in well-controlled ways. It really is just a rescaling of axes in that sense, because the only dipole moment that we take as input is the permanent dipole moment, right? Yeah, we're not really talking about transition. But other things like polarizabilities and polarizability anisotropy, all that sort of stuff will shift our results. But
next order of things, there are some folks who have sold out other molecules in one
piece of protocol.
I got 10 minutes extra now. No? Okay. So first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation to come here and for the wonderful workshop, and for the opportunity to taste the best cookies at this side of the Atlantic Ocean. So, or the Pacific Ocean. Okay. Today I would like to tell you something about polar molecules in one-dimensional optical lattices, in particular in disorder of one-dimensional optical lattices. So, as we have seen in previous talks, ultra-cold gases in optical lattices offer a lot of possibilities for lattice models. The simplest version of it is, for example, you have bosons. They move in the lowest band. They have some hopping. They have some on-site interactions. And this can be described by a Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian with hopping to the nearest neighbor and an on-site interaction here. So the phases of this have been already discussed here in the ground state. You have the superfluid phase, but if you are commensurate filling, you can enter into a phase which is called the Mott insulator phase, which is a gapped incompressible insulator. So interestingly, and this has been also mentioned at several talks, you can actually map this in different ways, actually into spin models and mimic spin models or try to learn something from the spin models. For example, the simplest version of it is the hardcore bosons, where you have bosons that they cannot live in the same site because they have strong repulsion. And then at sufficiently low filling, you basically have just one particle per side or zero. So you can say zero is up, one is down, and then you can map this into a spin. Well, this is the spin projection in the z direction, and basically this transforms into a so-called XX Hamiltonian, where you have basically XX interaction and YY interaction. Yeah, so this is the simplest example. So for a dipole gas, inter-site interactions become important. Yeah, so you have interaction to the nearest neighbor, to the next nearest neighbor, and so on. And actually, I will cut to the nearest neighbor, because to the nearest neighbors, actually, you recover many of the physics. There is some physics that you don't recover, like phases with longer periodicity than two. And actually, inter-site interactions have been already observed, not in polar molecules, but in dipolar condensates. So there was no talk yet on dipolar condensates. There will be a talk tomorrow of Bruno. But dipolar interactions have been shown already to play an important role in dipolar chromium condensates in optical lattices in Stuttgart. And actually, we have collaborated with the group of Tillmann Pfau recently on showing that inter-site interactions may destabilize a condensate. And actually, some funny things that can happen with dipolar systems in time of flight. So for the experimentalists in the audience, you can basically collapse in time of flight even if your system was stable in the drop, which is a kind of very peculiar thing that happens. And also, I would like to advertise the talk of tomorrow of Bruno on spin dynamics of condensates in lattices, where they have observed interesting inter-site effects. But here, I would like to concentrate mostly on on these sort of lattice models. And here there was already some comments of what can happen in these systems with when you have this inter-site interaction. So you may have, for example, that your particles, if they are half filling, they don't like to have a neighbor close by, and they prefer to be placed two sides away. So this is this density wave. You may keep the this order and at the same time keep off diagonal long range order and keep it into the super solid phase. You may have interlayer superfluids here with molecules belonging to different sites. You may have self-assembled crystals, metastable states, and much more. And there is a very nice review of Misha Baranov, Marcello Dal Monte, Guido Pupillo, and Peter Zola in this zone, which I recommend. So in one-dimensional systems, you have the inter-site interactions also lead to very rich physics for one-dimensional chains and for ladders. And I don't have time to review all, so I will mostly concentrate on these two issues, in particular on the issue of disorder, and in particular I will be very interested on this phase, which is called Haldane insulator. I was planning to talk about simulation of spin orbital models, but I think it's better if I just concentrate on this, and I will just refer to this and to this reference, and if you want, I can comment privately on how to do that. So, since I am going to talk about disorder, let me mention just briefly how do you engineer disorder in optical lattices. So basically, you take a lattice and you do something with it in such a way that the on-site energy changes slightly from side to side. This may be done in two ways, which are not equivalent. One is to use speckle light, which is basically this grainy spots that you see when you shine a laser on a diffuser, like for example the wall. This creates a sort of quasi-random, it's not completely random, it has still some correlations inside. Yes, but this has been used to observe Anderson localization in the experiments of Alain Aspect in one-dimensional lattices, but also recently in three dimensions, and also recently three dimensions in the group of Brian DeMarco. The other non-equivalent way is to use bichromatic lattices. So you use a main lattice, which is creating you this main optical lattice. I mean, this is the main laser. And you use a second one, which is beating with the first one. And this frequency is not commensurate to that one. This creates you a quasi-periodic potential, or quasi-disorder, as you want to see, right? And this actually has been employed, especially in experiments in Florence, in the group of Giovanni Modugno and Massimo Guscio, to study also localization effects. So in this talk, I would like, first of all, to discuss one-dimensional gases at unit filling, which is what I will be interested here, and then I will discuss different types of disorder and how these different types of disorder affect the the physics of one-dimensional polar gases at unit filling. So why one-dimensional gases at unit filling are interesting? So let me take this model that I was discussing before with these inter-site interactions. I consider an average filling one. And then I can do the similar trick that I was telling to you at the beginning of the talk. So I will map occupation into spin. Sorry. So if my if I have zero particles in a site, I say that this is a spin projection one. If I have one particle, this is a spin projection zero. If I have two particles, this is the spin projection minus one. So you can ask me what happens if there is more than two particles. Well, in that case, the picture breaks down, right? So then I can do I can formalize this doing the so-called Holstein-Prioukov transformation. And if I do that, then this Hamiltonian becomes this one, apart from some extra terms here, and apart from the terms which are larger than two in the field. So this Hamiltonian is a spin-spin Hamiltonian similar to the ones shown by Alexei. So I have this XXYY term, which is the same that I had showed you before in the hardcore, because this is basically the hopping. I have here the Z-set interaction, which is given just by this inter-site interaction. And I have this term here, which is proportional to the spin projection in the square, which is basically given by just the fact that I can have more than one particle in the site. This is the on-site interaction, this I didn't have before in the hardcore. And all the physics will be given just by how big is this guy and how big is that guy. So what is known in the spin chains? In the spin one chains, this is a paper several years ago, you can have three possible phases. One is the nail phase, so something like plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. If this delta is sufficiently large. Then you have the large D phase, if the D parameter is large enough, so the name is not very original. Say this is the large D phase. And here you basically have something like 0, 0, 0 everywhere, but from time to time you have plus, minus, or minus, plus pairs here. This in the bosonic language, we will see it later on, is a very well-known phase. And then you have the Haldane phase, which is this thing which is in between, which is a sort of diluted gas of defects. So these plus minus defects here, which appear from time to time, are ordered in an antiferromagnetic way, but you don't know where they are. Yes? So the number of zeros in between is unknown. If now you pass to the bosonic picture, yes, then apart from the fact that at low interactions you will have a superfluid, you get a very similar picture. So the nail phase is the density wave phase, so empty, doubly occupied, and so on. The mod insulator phase is the equivalent of the large D phase. So basically I have 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, and from time to time I have pairs. And I have the Haldane insulator phase, yes, which was proposed in this context by Ehud Alman, which is something like I have 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, and then I have somewhere an empty site, and then the next in the row, the next defect in the row will be a doblon, the next in the row will be an empty site, and so on. So let's try to understand why this phase is interesting by having a look to what is called the string and the parity order. So a Haldane phase, this type of phase, possess something which is called the string order. So let's see what is this is the string order. I take two sites, like I and j, where I have a defect, because otherwise this would be zero, because the defect is one minus the occupation. And this here, this is just counting the number of defects that I have in between, and if it is even, it's one. If it is odd, it's minus one. So in this case, let's do the math. This is one, this is one. So I have no defects, so this is one. This guy is plus one, this guy is minus one, so I have minus one, 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 minus one, so this is one. Yeah? I take two other defects, for example, and this will be also one. I take any other possible state that I have here, and this string order will be still different than zero. And this is, I take the limit when this tends to infinity, and this gives me the order parameter. Now, I can define something which looks similar, but which do not have these borders here, and which is simply counting the number of defects which I have between two sites. So let's take many combinations, many possible Haldane states like this one, which are, because my state, of course, will be a linear combination of many of these states. I take two sites, and I count the number of defects which is in between. And since the defects are moving, so to say, they are fluid, they can go through these edges here. And this means that the number of defects that I can have here has no defined parity. And as a matter of fact, the parity is zero. For the Mott insulator, the opposite is true. The string order is zero, and the parity is different than zero. And actually, for the state, this sort of cartoonish state for the Mott insulator, like 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, the parity is 1. Yes? But actually, the presence of these defects reduce the parity. And actually, this reduction of the parity has been observed experimentally by in situ measurements in the group of Immanuel Bloch. So let's see what happens when we put this one-dimensional polar gas with uniform bound disorder. So what do I mean by that? So I have this bounded box disorder here. So it's a uniform disorder, but between some maximal and minimal value, minus delta and plus delta. This is somehow similar to what I will have with the speckle. It's not completely true, but it's something similar. And for nonpolar bosons, this gives, in addition to the Mott insulator and the superfluid phase, a well-known phase, which is so-called the Bose class phase. This, contrary to the Mott insulator, is a gapless compressible insulator. So if I have a look to the phase diagram at unit filling, actually this was worked already many years ago by Bilitzberger and Ulrich Schwellberg. So you get the Bose class phase as a function of disorder and on-site interaction. You get Bose class phase, superfluid phase, and Mott insulator phase. And the Bose class phase is going all the way around, and this is the so-called superfluid finger, right? So now we will take these two things. So what happens without disorder, which is this, and what happens with disorder and without dipolar interaction, which is that. And let's try to combine both of them and see what happens, in particular with in this region of values of the onset interaction, where I have this Haldane insulator. Yeah. This corresponds to, for the case without the dipolar interaction, this corresponds to this cut here. So let's have a look. These are the DMRG calculations. So this is the phase diagram. So let's try to have a look to the phase diagram. And let's see what happens there. Well, first of all, the superfluid vanishes for growing nearest neighbor interaction. This is because this superfluid finger basically shrinks down, shrinks when you inject the, when you have this nearest neighbor interaction. And after you get the superfluid to Bose glass transition at Latinger parameter 3.5, which is something which is quite well known from Jean-Marc and Schultz. Now, other thing that you see here is that actually it's an interesting question whether the Bose glass goes all the way to zero between the Mott insulator and the Haldane insulator. Actually, this phase transition here is a Gaussian phase transition here, and the question is whether this line is actually a stable line or not with respect to disorder. This is very difficult to address numerically, but one can address this problem with a renormalization group. And you can see that depending on this on-site interaction, which at the end of the day depends on the Latinger parameter at this point, which is a gapless one, this tells you whether you are going to have that this phase goes all the way down till there or not. Yes, in this particular case it does, but for other values where this Latinger parameter is larger, actually, actually this line survives for finite disorder. The Bose glass appears for finite disorder. Other thing which appears there is that the density wave phase disappears even for very small disorder. Yes. So here there was the density wave, and now it's not there. The Bose glass starts here immediately, and the reason is the so-called Imrima argument, yes, which was proposed many years ago. So the Imrima argument is something quite simple. I take my density wave, my beautiful density wave, like 0, 2, 0, 2, 0, 2, yes, which has this order parameter, which in the spin language is the so-called stagger magnetization, and I will have a gap for flipping a spin here. Now, suppose that I have this order. I take my beautiful guy here, and I do the following. I take one chunk of it, of some size L, and I invert all the spins. Where I had a 0, I have a 2 now, and vice versa. This creates two defects here, right, which increases the energy. But now the question is whether for my system it will be energetically favorable or not. The question is that now I have disorder. This disorder has an average 0, but the variance is not 0. So this means that I will have some anomalous regions at which I will, for my system, will be actually favorable to flip all the spins. Yeah? And actually, this variance increases with the square root of the length for big L. And as a matter of fact, this is what I may lose in energy, and this is what I gain in energy. So the question is whether this gains with respect to that. If this is the case, then my system will prefer to have a domain. And this is indeed what happens if your system size is sufficiently large. You get a formation of domains. The domain destroys this order. Yes. And the gap is destroyed because now the excitations are not simply just creating a flip, yes, but it's just simply moving the walls, and this you can move with basically arbitrarily small energy. So the gap disappears. So this is what is happening there. Of course, in finite systems, basically you get a very small disorder, so to say, to get the. But this very small disorder is very small even compared to the initial gap that you had for without disorder. This you can check numerically as well. Then, the Haldane insulator phase survives, but its character actually changes. Yes. Before, so with pure systems, you had string order different than zero, and the parity order is zero. Now the parity order is different than zero, and the reason for this is actually quite simple to understand. The parity order was zero because the defects here were fluid; they were moving all the time. Now what happens in the presence of disorder is that they localize. Yes. You localize the defects, this sort of disorder reduces the mobility of the defects, while still keeping their antiferromagnetic ordering. Yes, and now you put two boundaries here, and these guys are not moving across the boundary. Yes, and of course you can cut it here, but this you will be unlucky, so to say. Yes, the easiest thing is that you cut outside here, and these guys are just half a defined parity. So the parity becomes non-zero due to these glassy defects that you have there. You get a sort of glassy Haldane insulator. Yes. So this is basically what happens in the case of bound box disorder. In the case of a quasi-periodic lattice, the situation is very different, as we will see. So this quasi-periodic lattice is given by this bichromatic lattice. And in this model, I can include this by putting this on-site energy in this form, right? This is the wave number of the main lattice, which is giving me the discretization of my model. And this is the wave number of the second lattice. So this is, I will call, the incommensurate parameter, yes, because I will assume that this is an irrational number. This is the so-called Aubry-André model, or also Harper model here. Now, in presence of this here, under proper conditions, you can get an extra phase, which has been called the incommensurate charge density wave. This was first studied by Tommaso Rochilde and by Corina Colas, Thierry Jamarchi, Uli Schwellbock and collaborators in this other paper. I will show several pictures of this paper. So how do to understand this extra phase which appears here? It's actually quite simple. Your system is this is incommensurate, but in a sense, you have like sort of rough super sites, right, in your system, which has a given site, which is given by the inverse of 1 minus this commensurability here. So due to the beating between the two periods of the two lattices, you will have something like a rough super site. Now, for a filling factor 1 minus R, you can understand this ICD phase, this incommensurate charge density wave, as a sort of filling one particle in each site, in each super site. For a filling factor R, it's like having one hole sitting on each super site. It's the same. Yeah. And actually, as a matter of fact, you get, if you plot occupation and chemical potential here, you see the appearance of these plateaus here, which are marking you the presence of this sort of gapped phases here, which are this incommensurate charge density waves. And actually, if you have a look to this type of fillings here, you get a phase here as a function of the on-site interaction. This is U0, and this is the disorder, which is for me is delta. And you get the superfluid, posed glass, and this incommensurate charge density waves. Now, if you go away from these fillings, like for example, for filling factor 1/2, you just get Bose glass and superfluid, this incommensurate charge density wave disappears. Now, interestingly, for filling factor 1, yes, this is the phase diagram, which was worked out here. And here you have the MOT insulator, superfluid, Bose glass, and here you have this sort of purple region here. And in this purple region, they were not completely sure because of the numerics, that there could be a small gap, yes, which is similar to having a sort of generalized incommensurate charge density wave. It's a phase which is gapped, Yes, but we should have a structure factor which is given by the sort of periods of this supersite. So, so I will now for the analysis of the problem. Now, when I include here the polar interactions, I will take a situation corresponding to this situation here. Right, it's not the same numbers because I will take different incommensurabilities here. But this is a situation in which I expect to have something like Mott-insulator superfluid, something, right, and the Bose class. So this is the phase diagram, which occurs in these systems, again with the MRG.